Story that broke late yesterday. Astronomers say they have found the first direct evidence for the mysterious stuff called dark matter. Dark matter, which does not emit or reflect enough light to be seen, is thought to make up 25% or so of the universe. By contrast, the ordinary matter we see is believed to make up no more than 5% of our universe. That means there's about 70% out there somewhere for something else. Until now, astronomers have only been able to infer that the existence of this dark material through the gravitational effects it has on ordinary matter. The researchers have discovered what is effectively the gravitational signature of dark matter. This signature was created by dark matter and ordinary matter being wrenched apart by the immense collision of two large galaxy clusters. In a moment, our guest is research astronomer Tom Van Flandern on Coast to Coast AM. Tom Van Flandern received his Ph.D. degree in astronomy from Yale University, and he spent 20 years at the U.S. Naval Observatory, where he became the chief of the Celestial Mechanics Branch. In 1991, Tom formed Meta Research to foster research into ideas not otherwise supported solely because they conflict with mainstream theories in astronomy. During the past few years, he has been a research associate at the University of Maryland's Physics Department. Tom organizes the Eclipse Edge expeditions to optimal solar eclipse viewing sites. He has been honored by a prize by the Gravity Research Foundation, taught astronomy at the University of South Florida and to Navy Department employees, and been a consultant to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. His website is metasearch.org. You can find it on coasttocoastam.com. I may have a little typo there. Tom, what is the website exactly? It's Meta Research, right?
Yes, it is, George.
Okay, great. How you been?
Oh, not bad at all. It's been a while. We were last year after they just smashed that probe into Comet Temple 1. And
oh, yeah.
Exciting result.
Absolutely. A little bit later on, next hour, we'll bring in your buddy Richard DeSee, and he'll join us with some of your discussions on exploding planets and the like, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Tom, let's talk about some things that have been going on in real science right now, and that has to do with the expanding the solar system from the 9 planets to at least 12 and probably many, many more. Are you in agreement? I guess they vote on it earlier toward the end of this week, but are you in agreement with their definition?
Well, yes and no. It's really hard to define a planet, and in fact, we really don't have the knowledge that it takes to make a definition that doesn't have some completely arbitrary elements in it. It used to be that we had planets that were big and moons that were much smaller and asteroids and comets. We could put everything into its own category, but now we've discovered bodies that fill that gap in between, and there's no particular size that you can point to that allows you to cut off and say, well, this anything bigger than this is a planet and anything smaller is a moon. So they've been struggling, and we kind of had a crisis over the last couple of years. The issue of whether or not Pluto should remain a planet because it's so small, or whether it should be demoted. Then the discovery of something even bigger than Pluto further out. And those two factors have made the astronomers have to face up to the issue, just what is the definition of a planet? They've settled on one now as a result of a committee arguing this out for many months. It's a very contentious issue, and there were probably more opinions than there were people in the meetings. But they've settled on something that's a compromise. It's sure not to please a lot of people, but given all the things that could have been much worse, I'm happy with this as a good compromise solution for the definition of a planet.
Now, you were involved in the discovery of one of Pluto's moons, weren't you?
That's true. Yes.
Which may be a new planet.
I'm of course not the discoverer. That honor goes to Jim Christie at the U.S. Naval Observatory, but I was working in an office just one floor above him at the time. He was working there and looking at these interesting images, and Bob Harrington and I were two dynamical astronomers at the observatory who were called on to evaluate the Christie's discovery and decide whether or not it was really a moon of Pluto and all the implications. That makes quite an interesting story in its own right.
You know, with all these possible objects, though, out there, Tom, there's also that possibility that some object out there, not planetary size, may collide with the planet, and that concerns me. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things the astronomers who are in Prague have been kicking around for so long now, and that is to really push and develop an effort. I thought we had one, but apparently it's not good enough to try to identify these objects out there.
That's true. At the moment, there are two separate pushes. One is to try and find all the objects that can possibly cross the Earth's orbit and therefore ever at any time in the future hit the Earth. So those are of concern for obvious reasons for us. And then the other effort is to look for more of these objects in a new asteroid belt in the outer solar system, out even beyond Pluto, where we're finding a rich new area of objects, big and small, by the thousands.
Well, they found one now, an asteroid, a real large one, which they also want to categorize as a planet. Ceres, is it? Is that how you pronounce it?
Ceres, usually.
Ceres. Mm-hmm. I mean, and again, with this one, it's not a round-shaped like we would expect a planet to. It's like a big rock.
Well, most of the asteroids are irregular in shape. Ceres is a halfway decent approximation of round because it is so big. It's the biggest of the asteroids or minor planets between Mars and Jupiter in the big gap where there ought to have been another planet, but instead there are tens of thousands of asteroids running around the sun. And Ceres is the biggest of them, so much so that it has more mass than all the others put together, which is why it is now, according to this proposal, it isn't official yet, but usually the recommendations of the committees are adopted. According to this proposal, Ceres is to become one of the new planets of the solar system.
And now there's talk that eventually, not right now, but eventually, our own moon could become another planet, based on their definition.
Well, that was a little wrinkle I pointed out. The definition calls for anything that is orbiting the sun as opposed to another planet will be a planet. And then they added the caveat that they were defining whether it was orbiting the sun or the planet by where the center of mass was. So for our moon, the center of mass of the Earth and moon falls inside the Earth. It's about 1,000 miles below Earth's surface. So that makes our moon a moon of Earth. And with Pluto's moon, Charon, the center of mass is outside of Pluto. So instead of Charon being a moon of Pluto, it's now going to be part of a double planet. And there's a lot of controversy about that. And I was the one that pointed out, well, our moon is evolving away from the Earth by tidal friction. It has been for billions of years.
Ever so slowly.
Ever so slowly, just an inch or so a year. But in a few billion years in the future, it'll be far enough away that the center of mass will be outside Earth. And apparently, according to the present definition, that will graduate the moon into being a part of a double planet.
Technically, how far can the moon travel away from the Earth? I mean, if it's an inch a year, 10 billion years from now, it could be way, way out there, couldn't it?
Well, there is a limit because it's getting the energy to get further away through tidal friction, and that's coming from the Earth's rotational spin.
Okay.
So eventually...
It'll stop?
The Earth will stop rotating almost completely and wind up with the same side always facing the moon, just as right now the same side of the moon always faces the Earth. And they'll wind up locked in that position, the moon orbiting the Earth at the same rate that both bodies rotate so that they always face each other. And then there'll be no further evolution of either orbit.
Okay, now I see the moon is about 239,000 miles away from the Earth. Has anybody calculated? We can do it. I've just not done the mathematics yet. Has anybody calculated in a billion years how far the moon will be from Earth?
Yes, it's about 400,000 to 450,000 miles, if memory serves. So not quite double the present distance. But then it stops.
So it would, though, look half as big, basically, as it is now.
That's right. And that will mean that we won't get any more total eclipses of the sun because the moon will be too small to completely cover the sun.
It really is strange to even think about it. But you know what, Tom? We're not going to be around to worry about it, are we?
That's true. That's a problem for the very distant future.
Well, I would hope there's going to be some Earthlings then. I'm not so sure about that.
You never know, species don't usually last for billions of years.
Have you, you know, as an expert research astronomer, have you kicked around the idea? Because now that they're saying that there are other planets in this solar system, which a few years ago, not a lot of people were prepared to say that. Zachariah Sitchin, Tom, has always talked about this extra planet that's in the solar system, this big one that's on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. I mean, is all that possible now? Is it possible that his interpretation of those old Sumerian texts and tablets might be accurate and that there is indeed another massive planet in the solar system comes around every 3,600 years and creates havoc because it gets so close to us?
Well, there are parts of that scenario that are possible, and there are parts that are not possible. The part about the 3,600 years, no, that was just a guess on Sitchin's part, and that turns out to be an unstable orbit. For example, Comet Hale-Bopp was around about a decade ago, and it was it came in on an orbit with a period of 4,200 years, which is crudely the same ballpark of the orbital period. But by the time it had gone through the solar system, even though it didn't come particularly close to anything, gravitational tugs by the planets changed its period from 4,200 years to 2,400 years. That was a random change. And that's the problem with anything on a 3,600-year orbital period. It's so vulnerable to change by small tugs by the planets that it's an unstable period, and it will change drastically with a single trip around the sun. So it just can't stay in that kind of orbit.
I want to save the Mars artifacts portion of our discussion when we get Richard C. in here later on tonight. But let's also talk about the Big Bang problems. And describe again for us, because I love it when it comes from a scientist, the theory of the Big Bang.
Well, back around in the 1920s, the astronomers discovered that galaxies, and the whole idea of galaxies was fairly new back then, because they used to think that it was all one big galaxy, and what we now know are galaxies with billions of stars outside of our galaxy and filling the rest of the universe. Back before the 1920s, they were thought to be nebulas inside our galaxy. But then they began to realize, no, they're actually thousands, millions, now we know of tens of billions of other galaxies, and filling up this huge universe. Well, what they discovered about those galaxies in the 20s was that the light from them is redshifted, which means that not that they're redder in color so much as that the spectral lines in them that indicate elements such as hydrogen are shifted toward the red end of the spectrum, which is an indication that they've lost energy when they arrive at us. So the only obvious explanation for such a thing would be if they were moving away from us, sort of like a passing train.
Right.
The train whistle has a high pitch as it approaches and a low pitch as it moves away. Well, the light from these galaxies has a low pitch. It's redshifted. It's lost energy. And they thought that meant the universe was expanding. So then if you trace that back, well, then you've got to put everything together at a point, at some point in time. And they didn't want to go back to the old idea that the Earth is the center of the universe. We learned our lesson with that when Copernicus pointed out that it wasn't. So they invented the Big Bang theory, which was a fancy way to have an origin for the universe, for all of these tens of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars in each one, originating at a point in time and exploding, spreading out 14 billion years ago, And the further away the galaxies are, the more redshift their light is. And it all fit together in an elegant description that you could give. And that's called the Big Bang Theory, with the single difference that in the astronomer's understanding of the Big Bang, which is quite different than the public view that is allowed to exist, this was not an explosion of matter into pre-existing space. Instead, it was an explosion of space itself. So there wasn't any space at all before the Big Bang.
Which is even more mind-boggling, Tom.
It is indeed. But that's the theory. No space at all. Space explodes, and that explosion is continuing to this day. And the reason why galaxies are getting farther apart is not because they're moving away from each other, according to the Big Bang, but because there is more space right now being created between us and nearby galaxies. So even though the other galaxy is standing still in its space, and we're standing still in our space, more space is appearing between us.
And it kind of pushes us out, basically.
Yeah, that's right.
That's fascinating. And here's the other thing. Where's it coming from?
Well, the whole theory involves creation from nothing. It requires a miracle, and it requires a continuous, ongoing miracle.
Is this like a divine type theory? Theory of God?
Correspondingly, it is the one theory of the origin of the universe that has been approved by the Roman Catholic Pope.
They like this one.
They like this one because it implies a creation event, obviously, and that would require that there be a God. Not that any of the other theories deny that fact, but the two fit together, so the Catholic Church really likes this particular version.
Are you a believer in the multiverse theory?
Not at all. In fact, there is I don't even like the terminology because the astronomers have already defined their terms very carefully. And when people want to take words that already have a well-defined meaning and
right.
then murk them up, it kind of makes a mess of things. Yes, the astronomer's definition of universe is everything that exists. Okay, so if it's everything, then there can't be multiple universes by definition.
Because that's already part and parcel of everything.
And the importance of making that distinction and saying there's only one universe is that when you want to talk about another universe or a parallel universe or anything like that, it forces you to say what you mean, and it's really hard to say what you mean when you're talking about a parallel or multiple universe.
Okay, but so I won't use the phrase multiverse, but do you think that there are other universes or just this one?
Well, by definition, there's only the one, and I would argue that we have fairly reliable both reasoning and evidence that the universe that we see consists of five and only five dimensions, three dimensions of space, one of time, and one of scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be infinitely divisible in scale. You may be able to get smaller and smaller all the way down and bigger all the way up. But there could not really rationally be other universes that simultaneously existed in this space, in this time. That would require two things to occupy the same place at the same time, which is something that has long been considered illogical.
How many physicists would agree that, basically the universe is growing from within?
The expansion of the universe,
yeah.
You mean? Well, my understanding is that a survey showed that 5 to 10% of the professional astronomers disagree with the Big Bang Theory, but they tend to keep it to themselves.
Okay, hold that thought right there, Tom. We'll be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. What's new for you in terms of research? What have you been working on these days? I went over your website all day today, and I mean, you've got some incredible things there.
Well, there is a lot exciting going on. There's a lot happening with alternative theories to the Big Bang. Perhaps one of the most interesting developments is that for almost a century now, we've had a speed limit to the universe. The speed of light was supposed to be the fastest thing possible,
mm-hmm.
and that is completely off now. We've now approved first that there was a flaw in the theory that the limit had to be an absolute limit, and secondly, that something is already violating it, namely gravitational force, which is propagating actually billions of times faster than the speed of light. So that's an exciting development, and one that has already been peer-reviewed and published in three different journals now, so it's been through the gamut.
What would have Albert Einstein have done today if he had known what we're beginning to know now?
I think he'd be very happy with the developments. Toward the end of his life, he was kind of upset because things had not worked out at all the way he had hoped. But things have evolved more in the direction of his instincts than in the instincts of the people who followed him. For just to take one of many examples, one of his students, John Wheeler, invented the concept of black holes, which are kind of popular in today's science. There are lots of reasons why black holes are impossible to exist, unlike the concept of collapsed stars that existed before it. But Einstein himself wrote a paper in 1939 proving that black holes were impossible. So he would agree with some of us about there not being such a thing, yet it's very popular in today's relativity, and it's all attributed to Einstein, quote unquote, meaning that if you want funding for your project, you just say you're trying to verify something else about Einstein's theory,
and you get your money.
That's about it.
Would this have a bearing on theories of time travel and the possibilities of?
Yes, it does. There are good reasons why time travel backwards in time ought to be physically impossible. Going forward in time, of course, is no problem.
Right.
That basically is just suspended animation. But going backward in time really gets you into causality problems because, of course, as soon as anything can go back in time, then it can change the past, which changes the present, and you have a logical dilemma. It goes deeper than that, but logic alone rules out the possibility of travel backward in time, independent of how smart any species ever become.
Well, if it does have a bearing on time travel, you know, some of the things we've kicked around in this program might make a lot of sense after a while, because it just seems that science is beginning to uncover and unravel new things all the time, things that years ago people would have thought would have been impossible or preposterous. Now we're talking about this. I mean, even just what you talk about tonight, the possibilities that we might be able to go faster than the speed of light in this universe, it's just astounding to me, Tom.
Yes, I agree with you, George. But on the point I think you're hinting at, that we may not be smart enough to know what things are possible and what not, we make a distinction in physics between the laws of physics, such as the law of gravity or the law of electromagnetism. Those are inventions of people, and they could change. We're discovering now that maybe gravity behaves a little differently on the large scale. So no matter how long the law has been around or how confident we are, those things can change. But there are also things called the principles of physics, such as you can't create something from truly nothing. That comes from logic alone. You can create something from things you can't see, but they have to be there. You can't have truly nothing and suddenly get something out of it. So there are rules like that called the principles of physics, which should be inviolate no matter what, by any species, no matter how smart.
I want to get back to the Big Bang again in this growing universe. I've had always, since I was a kid, this perplexed question of who are we, what are we, why are we? And if we take spirituality out of this for just a moment, I don't know if we can, but I think we have to for this. I have no idea what we're doing here, Tom. You know, and again, take spirituality out of it. What are we doing here? Why are we here? What are we?
Well, if you look at it from the perspective of One of the other cosmologies that's called the meta model, which I'm very partial to, it would say that that the universe is infinite, not just in space, but also eternal in time and infinite in scale as well. So it is infinitely divisible all the way down, and you can assemble structures at indefinitely large scales too. And it says that even though details everywhere differ, and forms differ, and forms come and go, and so on, but in essence, the universe is the same at all times in the past and future, at all places in space, and at all scales. And that would mean that we're part of this coherent whole. It's almost like a religious concept.
See, you really, eventually, you can't rule it out. You have to put it back into the equation somehow.
Well, yes, in the sense that our thoughts about the big picture and what it's all about,
yes,
inevitably go there. But there's good reason to think that we're part of this ongoing process, and that even though the universe is eternally old, every living thing has its time, and to that, even the little microbes that live just a moment in time to us, to them it seems a full lifetime, and things that, like sequoia trees that may last for tens of thousands of years, to the extent that they can sense what's going on, that would seem like a normal lifetime to them. So for everything, time passes at a rate that seems to fill a lifetime, and then you're gone and somebody else comes along. But we all get about the same opportunity in this universe, and it may have always been that way and always will be.
Now, hear me out. There's a method here to my madness, but do you believe in life after death, and the existence of probably the angelic realm?
Well, George, I make an effort as a trained scientist not to do anything with my thought processes to which the word believe would be properly applicable. I consider everything to be a hypothesis,
mm-hmm,
and my reaction to any hypothesis you want to name is, how can we test that? But the one you just named is really hard to lay specs down to test.
It sure is. It sure is. And, you know, sometimes you have to go on faith. Sometimes you have to go on experience. Sometimes intuition. But you're right. It's very difficult to judge. I wish science could come up with a great way to judge it, because maybe we'd get some answers there, Tom. And the reason why I ask you as a scientist is because I'm still wondering about what these other, I'll call it a dimension. And you mentioned that there are five dimensions. Some people think that there are more. You know, what if these areas do exist in this universe? Maybe they were always there. They're a very natural part of existence. If it's out there, I think it even expands everybody's theory of just what the universe is and why it was formed and why it's here.
Well, that's true if in our imaginations, but then it comes back to we usually try to constrain our imaginations with reality testing, and what kind of a test can we do to determine if these other dimensions or anything that we imagine exists? And the answer is often there isn't the slightest trace of physical evidence that we've ever thought of or encountered for that. All we have to go on is that we have powerful imaginations.
Take us through now the exploded planet hypothesis that you have. You call it the EPH. And if you can, kind of paint us a picture, first of all, Tom, about the formation of our solar system and how this evolution occurs.
Well, we've learned so much about the solar system. And the old idea was it formed out of a big cloud of gas and dust. Parts of that condensed to form the sun. Other parts condensed to form the planets. Other parts formed the moons going around the planets, and that all happened about 4.5 billion years ago, and it's been pretty much the same ever since. The new picture is that there's a lot more to it than that. Probably the cloud of gas and dust that formed the sun may have formed other stars at great distances, but probably not planets. Instead, the sun, when it accumulated enough material, would spin up and it would condense. It would contract under gravitational influence, and like an ice skater pulling in our arms, it would spin faster and faster as it contracted, and finally spin so fast that gravity can't keep it together anymore, and it fissions off pairs of planets at both ends. And then it slows down, and the process continues until it spins up, overspins again, and fissions off another pair, and so on. It happens repeatedly, and the planets evolve out by tidal forces. So that's another way of forming planets, and one that seems to work much better in modern thinking. Enters a lot of problems that the old one didn't, but it means that planets and later on moons form in twin pairs for the most part.
Now, let's talk then about the possibility that in this solar system, and we're not talking about the ones that are way out there then, that planets exploded. How do we know that? How do you know that?
Well, it began with the finding that there are these four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and then the four gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and a big gap between those sets of four where there was room for another planet, but instead of finding a planet there, we found thousands and tens of thousands of fragments. And so immediately there were two thoughts. One is that it was a place where a planet might have formed but never came together, and the other is that a planet did form there and blew up. So those two theories have been competing with one another for over 200 years now, and first one's been in vogue and then the other. The evidence now has kind of gone all in one direction of late, and the evidence now so strongly favors the exploded planet hypothesis that there's really, I hate to say it because it's definitely a minority theory in the field, but the evidence is so strong and so compelling and pervasive that I think there's no longer any room for doubt that the exploded planet idea is the correct one of those two.
And this planet was in that location when it was whole?
That's correct. That was the original finding and the original evidence. But since then, having recognized that there was this one explosion, we've found evidence for others too. And the picture we pieced together now, after about a decade of trying to put the pieces together, is that the original solar system consisted of 12 major planets. Venus and Earth were a twin pair. Two other planets between Earth and Jupiter were a twin pair that has since exploded. There was another twin pair beyond Jupiter, and Jupiter and Saturn were a twin pair. Uranus and Neptune were a twin pair, and then another twin pair beyond Neptune.
And what do you mean by twin pair again?
When they fission off the sun, they fission in twin pairs, one on each side, and they're planets that are very, very similar to one another.
Okay.
Venus and Earth are very similar.
Okay.
Now, Mercury and Mars and Pluto were not in that list, and each of those is apparently a former moon. Mercury used to orbit Venus the way our moon orbits Earth, but it escaped and went into its own orbit the sun. And Mars apparently was a moon once of one of these other planets.
That blew up.
That blew up. And that left only Mars in the orbit of Mars. And the other planet further out blew up, and that left Ceres in its orbit, one of these other, one of the new 12 planets.
Okay. Now, do you believe that Mars might have had its atmosphere, might have had the oceans like they believe, and lost it during the explosion period?
That's right. There's good evidence when we look at Mars close up with spacecraft not only, just as you say, that it has lost a lot of its original atmosphere, probably from an event like an explosion, but also the evidence is very strong that it was a moon at the time of the explosion, because it's been blasted to heck on one side, saturated with craters, some of them huge. There's a one crater that's 3,000 kilometers across.
The side that took the brunt of the explosion.
Exactly. And the other side is the flattest, smoothest surface in the whole solar system, almost devoid of craters.
Like it was on the other side.
Exactly.
Blocked.
Exactly.
What caused the explosions of the planets?
We have three different theories of planet explosions that have come along in the last few years.
And I'm going to have you wait until we come back at the top of the hour with these three theories, Tom. I got to tell you, fascinating. How did you come to the theory, though?
Well, it was pretty much the investigations into the nature and origin of gravity that led us in the right direction. And we already know that things like stars explode in novas and supernovas, and there were some keys missing in that sequence of understanding those explosions. We put it all together, and it worked for planets, too.
Okay, well, stay with us, Tom. Tom's website, linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. It is metaresearch.org. Fascinating information. As a matter of fact, get up to coasttocoastam.com, because next hour, when we bring in Richard C. Hoagland at about the halfway point, we're going to talk about the Mars artifacts with Richard and Tom Van Flandern as well. Fascinating topic. But when we come back, let's get his three theories on why he believes planets explode, and is it very possible that good old planet Earth can explode as well? We'll be back in a moment. Why do they fail? Well, before the break, Tommy, we were going to talk about the three theories of why planets might explode.
Yes, indeed. The simplest one to say in a few words is the is what's called changes of state. It means that when you change the temperature or pressure of things, say water, you get a new state, like ice or steam.
Right.
And if that happens inside a planet, the temperature or pressure changes and you reach a critical point, you can change something inside the planet from one state to another, and that usually means a change of volume. So the planet will then either collapse if the volume inside is smaller, or it will expand explosively. So that one we can say in a few words. Also, the second idea can be said fairly briefly, too, and that is that there is such a thing as a natural fission reactor. In fact, we found one on Earth over in Gabon in Africa. There is a place where we found radioactive nucleides that indicate there was a natural fission reactor operating in that area. The going theory is that uranium was leached from rocks by flowing water and reached a point where it collected in a dam somewhere and reached a critical mass. But the point is that we already know that such a thing exists, because we've seen evidence here, right here on Earth. But if you extend that idea to what may be going on in the cores of planets, where there's probably a lot of uranium and other heavy elements, that leads to another possible energy source and mechanism for planets to explode. The third one is the most plausible of the three, but probably all three mechanisms are active. But the third one came out of our understanding of the origin and nature of gravity that has evolved in the last four or five years. And that's quite different than the old idea. It's called pushing gravity, which is a strange name if you haven't heard of it before. But it can be best described this way. We know that there are air molecules around us all the time, even though we can't see them. Well, there are even smaller things in this theory filling the whole universe called gravitons. They're much smaller even than atoms or any quantum particle. And there's a constant stream of them bombarding us from all directions all the time, just as air molecules are, but all over the universe. And these are called gravitons. And if there are any two bodies out in isolated in space, some of the more of the gravitons will hit them on the outside than the than between them, because they'll shadow each other from some gravitons.
Is there any warning when the planet explodes, Tom, assuming, let's say, there are inhabitants on the planet?
Yes, there would have to be. There would be geophysical instabilities in the core of the planet that would probably develop over a period of thousands of years. And a planet would probably give plenty of warning to its occupants that things were going bad.
Is the explosion of the planet an evolution? Is it something that occurs quite naturally in time? Or is it something, is it a fluke based on these three theories that just happens every once in a while?
Well, there are two kinds of conditions we can deduce from the circumstances that have already happened. One is if a planet is put under stress. That can result in changes in the pressure in the core and the collapse of a core, which can produce one of these kinds of explosions.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, a collision, it can't really, a collision, however large, can't cause a planet to explode directly because of the collision, but it might destabilize a planet so that its internal processes go haywire, and that can explode it, or a moon getting too close or something like that. But the other circumstance seems to be a kind of natural evolutionary path, that planets are always either heating up as they contract under the force of gravity, or else they're emitting more heat into space than they take in, and they're cooling off. And the just gradual natural process over millions and billions of years of cooling inside can eventually lead to one of those critical points where you change state, and then suddenly there'll be a change of volume, and then you can have a rapid accumulation of gravitons in the core and a virtually instantaneous explosion.
If the solar system is 4.5 billion years old, when did these planets explode?
Of the major planets, we have evidence that there were two explosions about 4 billion years ago, right back at the beginning. It's known by the astronomers as the period of the late heavy bombardment. There were two other planets that exploded about 1 billion years ago, and those are the ones that formed all the new asteroids in the new asteroid belt out beyond Neptune and Pluto.
All right.
And then there was another pair of planets between Mars, between Earth and Jupiter, one in the orbit of Mars, one midway out to Jupiter, that apparently exploded in the period from 250 million years ago for the outer one to just 65 million years ago for the inner one in the orbit of Mars. The one 65 million years ago, that was in the orbit of Mars, and it's the one that freed Mars, that was a moon of that planet, into its own orbit. But that explosion did enough damage that the Earth felt the impact of it too. And that, of course, on Earth, things changed drastically at that time. That's when all the dinosaurs died. But 70% of all species were wiped out. There was a single global fire. We've already discovered not just the Big Chicxulub impact in the Yucatan Peninsula, but 15 different major craters over the Earth, all associated with the same time period, changes in the atmosphere and ocean and so on. It was a very difficult time for life on Earth.
On the possibility scale, how would Earth fit into this equation as a possible planet that could explode?
Well, explosion seems to be the natural end state of planets, just as it is for stars and other types of bodies.
So you think every planet eventually will explode?
There's a good chance that is what we will find out at the end of this research. But the good news is that Earth's already been around 4.5 billion years and is showing no present evidence of instability on any serious scale. So if, with any luck, we've got billions of more years to go.
If there were inhabitants on some of these planets, and if they were technologically advanced, they would have been able then to know that there's something wrong with our planet, maybe not know that it would blow up, but would they have time then, if they had the technology, to leave their planet and go somewhere else?
Yes, they probably would. And there is, of course, conjecture in connection with the Mars anomalies that we're coming to later that maybe whoever did those was involved in just such a scenario. They knew that the end of their home world was coming and possibly emigrated. And one of the conjectures is that this is one of the places they emigrated.
Yeah, and the atmosphere was probably similar to theirs. It was breathable air. They probably were able to do this with much of a problem. Or maybe they genetically altered whatever beings were on this planet at the time.
Yeah, it's a little more likely the latter. The chances are very poor that one species from one planet would be able to adapt to another. But if they're smart enough to have space travel, their knowledge of genetic engineering would be pretty advanced. And they could come here, take a species such as, chimps or apes, that's already adapted to this biosphere.
Or Neanderthal man?
And genetically engineer them to be smarter and more dexterous and more like the parent species, and yet be still adapted to this biosphere.
Okay, but that wouldn't help them out in that they'd have to still live in their spaceships or someplace.
That's true. Once your home planet blows up, you can last only a few generations at most. But the desire to preserve the species would be so strong that if it were the only option, you would genetically engineer a hybrid species and let it survive.
If you were a couple hundred thousand miles out from one of these exploding planets, you were in a spaceship looking at it, Tom, what would you see? Would it simply crack up and fall apart, or would it have this massive one burst and it would be gone with fragments everywhere?
Well, we're used to seeing explosions like that in our movies. Star Wars comes to mind. There are a few others. But the reality is that planets are such big affairs that even a monster explosion originating in the core would probably take 5 or 10 minutes for the blast wave just to reach from the center of the planet to the surface. So it would look like a fairly slow motion affair if there were people on Earth, there weren't, but to look up 65 million years ago and see the explosion of the parent planet of Mars, it would take months for the debris to spread out over the sky and finally reach Earth.
So you've devoted many years, Tom, to these theories. Could you honestly say you think you're right, you know you're right? How would you categorize this?
Well, first thing I do is take me out of the equation. I'm after the truth, and
all right.
it's the hypothesis.
Fair enough.
And I think the hypothesis has now made so many correct predictions and not failed on any of its predictions, things that have astounded the other astronomers. It was the first to predict that they would find satellites of asteroids and satellites of comets, salt water and meteorites. It predicted the times and rates of meteor storms. Best. It predicted the circumstances for the deep impact mission, even where the mainstream was too timid to make any predictions at all. And it predicted what they would see in the Stardust mission, where they collected dust from comets, advanced elements that have been heated much hotter than they thought any comet could have been heated. All of these are correct predictions of the hypothesis, so it's doing so well that at the very minimum we can say it is a much more useful theory than anything the mainstream has today.
It is. It is a fascinating theory. And tell me then, we're going to bring Richard in about 8 minutes or so. Tell me how you met Richard. How did this relationship occur?
Let's see. I believe that I'm not positive when the first time we may have encountered one another, but back in the late 80s or early 90s, we encountered one another again online and in discussions of Cydonia, the area on Mars where the face is, and other famous anomalies. And that our discussions there, first via the Internet, eventually evolved into following up our mutual interests. And I can't now recall the first occasion or meeting when we encountered each other in person, but it's happened many times since.
What did you think when you were talking to him about Cydonia? And you had this guy saying, Look, I've looked at these this Viking photograph, and I think there's a face on Mars. Well, I mean, what did you think? Like, you know, I'm going to tippy-toe away from this guy, or what?
Well, it was interesting. Back in those days, that was before the we had all this spacecraft evidence with high-resolution cameras. Richard was convinced early on from his investigations that the face on at Cydonia had to be artificial. And, of course, the mainstream astronomers were equally convinced that it was natural. And I took the neutral stance of you should keep an open mind until the evidence is compelling one way or the other, because taking a position creates biases, taking a position either way. And Richard offered to bet me at 100-to-1 odds that the face would turn out to be artificial. And I said the same words to him. And then by chance online, I was having a discussion with some of the mainstream astronomers, and one of them spontaneously piped up and said, "Tom, I'll bet you at 100-to-1 odds that it turns out to be natural." Well, I recognized an opportunity when I saw one and took both ends of the 100-to-1 bet so that for every dollar I bet both ways, I'm sure to make 99. But the point of the example is that when people are going by their strongly held beliefs that are really biases, it does prejudice their thinking to later developments. They couldn't both have been right.
Oh, that's true. Absolutely true. I can't wait to bring him in with you shortly when we talk about some of these artifacts. How would you categorize yourself now, Tom? I mean, once mainstream, no longer. Or are you still?
Well, kind of depends on definitions, but I'm certainly trained in the mainstream, and I go to their meetings, and it's a kind of interesting phenomenon, George, that I'll go to the mainstream astronomer meetings, and some of my friends will chat with me kind of off to the side where they're not too conspicuous. but for the most part, people tend to avoid me now because I've been critical a lot of the mainstream theories. Whereas if I go to meetings of dissident groups, I tend to get just the opposite kind of reaction. I tell my wife that I value going to both types of meetings because it keeps me balanced. I get lots of criticism and lots of praise, and it keeps me at an even keel.
What do you think about what they think about you?
Well, I think it's a very natural reaction because I've talked to many of my colleagues in depth, and I've said, for example, to a couple of them who are very invested in mainstream theories, I said, "Well, tell me, what would it mean to you personally if it turned out that the exploded planet hypothesis were correct?" And the answer at first surprised me quite a bit, because the answer was they'd quit astronomy and do something else for a living. And I thought, oh, why, that's so drastic. But after a while, I understood it. They've trained their whole lives. They're an expert in this field. They're an expert in this theory. And to have the very basis of what makes them an expert and feel special undermined is very disheartening to a person. They figure, well, they've wasted their life. They'll rail against that possibility right up till they die. And this is what led to that old saying, science progresses one funeral at a time.
Well, I got to tell you, you've done some great work here, Tom. And, you know, this planet needs people who think outside the box. And it's exciting. When you were a kid, did you ever think your path, you'd go down this path?
No, I sure didn't. Even in the first 10 years of my career, I was a respected mainstreamer, and I had no idea even then that I would be going down this path. But way leads on to way.
Absolutely. And you're still not off the path yet, Thomas.
I'd like to think so.
Okay, well, we're going to bring in Richard C. Hoagland right after this break, and we'll talk about some of these Mars artifacts. And have you ever said anything about the moon in terms of what you think it is? Do you think it broke off from the planet?
Yes, I do, and that's in a chapter in my book was devoted to the origin of the moon. Quickly in passing, my book is Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets. And I mentioned all four of the major theories for the origin of the moon and show why the evidence strongly favors the theory that it did break off from the Earth, fissioned from the Earth, the same way the planets fissioned from the sun, as opposed to the big whack theory, which says that something came along and slammed into the Earth and broke it off and then re-accreted. That's impossible.
All right, stay with us. Our special guest, Tom Van Flandern. Tom will stay with us next hour for questions. Richard C. Hoagland joins us next, too, as we talk about Mars artifacts. And welcome along. I'm George Norrie with Tom Van Flandern and Richard C. Hoagland. We're bringing him in now from theenterprisemission.com as we talk about Mars artifacts. Basically, what this conversation will do is going to pick up from the exploded planet theory. Let's bring in you, Richard. How are you, Mr. Hoagland?
Good evening, Mr. Norrie.
Good to have you with us.
Mr. Lightworker.
Oh, I'm always there, and we've got Mr. Van Flandern,
and
the PhD.
And my dear friend, Tom. You know, Tom, you sound so good having moved from D.C. to God's country on the west. Robin and I were sitting here saying, God, he sounds fantastic.
I feel much better, too. This is great out here.
I could tell. I could definitely tell. I've got to tell George and our intimate millions of friends how you and I really met.
Yes.
We met, Tom and I met, we hadn't known each other. We were in a cafeteria at the DPS meeting in Pittsburgh back when a guy named Stockman, who was the budget director for Ronald Reagan, was trying to rip the rug out from under the budget of the Voyager spacecraft. And essentially, when they passed the two outer planets, nobody would have been listening because NASA was not going to have any money mandated by Stockman to listen. And he and I were separately there, up in arms at this outrage, one of many that's been committed by politicians against space over the years. And we sat down and were kind of commiserating on what we could do, you know, to shake things up, obviously both revolutionaries. And I was this squeaky mainstreamer, you know, from NASA.
You were a mainstreamer?
I was so squeaky mainstream, you know, Tom could hear me squeak across the cafeteria. And I met this raving lunatic who was talking about planets blowing up and black stuff smearing the front of Iapetus and dust clouds smearing out the sun. And I thought, what in the world? Then later, of course, the tables turned. And I'm talking about wild things like ancient high-tech civilizations and super races on Mars and statues a mile long and 1,500 feet high. And then he's saying, I'm not quite, you know, like he became Mr. Conservative. Then, you know, the tables turned again and he's, you know, embraced not only Cydonia, but things all over Mars, which I find a little bit hard to swallow in some cases. And then I'm looking at the exploded planet hypothesis, and I find evidence with Mars, and the tidal bulges that Mars had to be a tidally locked satellite of the planet, and the damn thing did blow up, and Mars was released in orbit around the sun. So we've had this race going back and forth, who can be the farthest far out and stay within science? And I've got some surprises from my friend Tom, because I've got some stuff, you know, some of which we're going to talk about at Joshua Tree, that is going to make his hair turn even grayer.
I haven't got many shades of gray left.
Well, obviously, let's assume for a moment that a planet did not explode, that Mars was not a moon, but was its own planet. I think we all agree something horrible happened to the planet, causing its atmosphere to just blow away. If Tom and Richard, the theory of the exploded planet didn't do it, what else could have occurred? Tom?
Well, the mainstream theory for a long time has been that there was some sort of an event that instead of cratering the southern hemisphere, they want to say something removed all the cratering on the northern hemisphere. They were thinking in terms of a global ocean or some sort of a cataclysm that kind of wiped out that surface, a collisional event or something else. They never were able to be pinned down on exactly what kind of event would do this. But that's still the alternative today, a sort of nebulous what happened to the northern hemisphere that made it so smooth instead of what happened to the hemisphere mm-hmm. with all the craters.
And how about you, Richard? If it wasn't the theory we are talking about tonight, the exploded planet, what's out there? What's left?
Okay, assuming we didn't have the evidence that we have marshaled in support of the EPHID and Mars as a former moon.
Right.
If you look at the solar system objectively and you say, okay, we've got civilization on Earth developing extraordinary technology, nuclear weapons, you know, fundamental forces that ultimately could wind up destroying civilization. And you look at Mars and you see obvious evidence, as we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes, of an extraordinary high-tech civilization capable of, in, you know, Kardashev's terms or in, you know, Michio Kaku's terms, of controlling the energies of an entire planet, you might lean toward the idea that there had been some god-awful war between factions, maybe between planets in the solar system of this high-tech civilization. I mean, we're doing it to ourselves right now, various ideologies
sure.
armed with high-tech weaponry. But this would be a weaponry just a bit beyond what we currently master, control, and it could literally have wiped out a global civilization. And so that's your other polar point, which is that they did it to themselves, and if they turned out to be us, and then some of us came here as refugees, and I like the idea that Tom says that such a culture would have had to have control of genetic engineering, biology,
yeah.
and they could have fashioned their descendants. In fact, if you want to get really metaphysical, there are plans for transplanting memories and mind, and you could talk about soul grafting or whatever, so you would actually be able to inhabit bodies even if you hadn't died yet. You'd basically make a new house to move into. I mean, that's not very far down the road from where our own technology and visions are going. So you could say that Mars was the object, a horrible object of a terrible war. If you bring these ideas together, which is where I'm going, it may be that the exploded planets of this solar system, some of them did not explode because of natural forces. Some of them exploded because people figured out the fundamental forces that can wreck whole worlds.
Well, there's a great theory, too, Richard. It might not have been soul grafting. Maybe they downloaded their memory into the bodies.
That's what I was talking about.
Okay, okay.
Now, the thing is, what makes this not science fiction but potential science is that every part of this is testable. All we need is data. All we need is an honest space agency, which we should have had for the last 40 years from the time we got the first pictures of Mars and the first pictures of the moon showing artifacts. They shouldn't have been stuffed in a drawer and put behind padlocks. We should have had access. We should have had open debate, discussion, you know, vigorous discussion. And we would be light years further along in knowing, A, what happened, and B, if we could be victims of similar things happening to us.
Okay, and let's assume that Tom is correct, and your theories are correct, that there was a planet that blew up, that Mars was a moon of this planet that blew up, and the inhabitants had some time, and they got off pretty darn fast. Is it also possible, though, Tom, that there might have been inhabitants on Mars, which was the moon at the time?
Yes, but the evidence we're finding on Mars is more suggestive, at least to my mind, of the kinds of things we might expect to find on our moon, the Earth's moon, in a few thousand years. That is, evidences of sort of a secondary civilization rather than a primary one. So we don't see cities and airports and highways and so on all over the planet, but we see kind of areas of activity as if they were built around stations or some commercial or scientific or technical purpose.
Of course, you don't know how much would be left that would be visible from orbit if a planet underwent such an extraordinary cataclysm. I mean, if it had water mm-hmm. and if, you know, the place next door blew up in its face, then the impact shock waves alone would cause tsunamis that would rage across the planet. And we see evidence in these images that I've been studying for years with some of my other colleagues of enormous mud flows and debris flows and catastrophic buryings. And now, because all that mud has dried out, what happens is you get erosion and what they call soufflation. and you get the emergence of pristine buried artifacts. I mean, Tom, I have got an image of one of the most pristine tetrahedral structures without any evidence of erosion except for an overlap of mud on one side that measures like five times the size of the Great Pyramid. And it has perfectly symmetrical curvilinear sides, a tetrahedral structure sticking up like 2,000-3,000 feet in the air, but with curvilinear sides touching the now desert floor. I mean, there's evidence all over, and that's where Tom and I are looking forward with incredible anticipation, along with the more keen members of this audience tonight, to the results from MRO, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. If we all get together and we all demand of this space agency and of Mike Griffin honesty for the first time in decades on this subject, we could, by next spring, we could, George, know if Tom and I are right about this.
And what a theory that would be. You guys would be on the cover of Time magazine if that happens.
Well, again, it's bigger than us because the human race, I mean, I have a very interesting new friend who is heading a science unit of a major network which is coming out to interview me at length about the intelligence hypothesis, and the show is supposed to air in the next 6 months, and I can't tell you more details, but when I can, you'll go, oh, my God, it's finally arrived. The intelligence hypothesis theory of Mars has finally hit mainstream, and one of the things that this individual said to me is they went over to the Zubrin Mars conference in Washington. It was a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And they call me up, and this is very interesting because I've had extensive conversations with this person now who has moved radically from how they were going to treat the subject initially, which was like a footnote in their program, to where it's going to be a major component. So politically, we've demonstrated enough evidence, and I gave them Tom's name, by the way. I don't know whether they've contacted him, but they had you on the list, Tom. This person said that the thing that struck them about what was going on at the Zubrin conference is how all these people, all these Mars people, these activists and grassroots Mars people that want to see a Mars mission a la the Bush, you know, initiative and all that, how they had their dreams stolen from them for decades. And I thought this was an incredible insight by a person coming to this from mainstream, realizing that if what we're saying is right, if NASA has been jiggering the data and people have been lying about what's on these pictures, then an entire generation has had their dreams of the solar system and what space can do for humanity and all mankind literally ripped from them and buried in a drawer, and this is the year it can finally come to an end if we all pull together.
Tom, do you believe this is all possible, too? Do you think NASA's been holding back like Richard Fields?
Well, I'm making the distinction between NASA and JPL, I think that there's a certain element of truth there. I see it more as motivated by survival than as some sort of a conspiracy to hide information. Jet Propulsion Laboratory there's been tentative justification put forward for missions from now up to 2016, and that's all based on the premise that by 2016 we want to be able to find out if life was ever possible on Mars. And if we suddenly jump the timetable to artifacts and intelligent life here that existed in relatively recent times, the justification for all those missions is undercut. It's kind of back to the drawing board.
If this planet that blew up had water, and I'm pretty sure at this point it probably did, and Mars had water, where did it all go after the explosion? Did it just, evaporate into the...
Go into space.
Into space, or did it go toward planet Earth, as some people have thought?
Well, when you spread a cloud that diffused out across the solar system, I mean, remember that line in Contact, Jodie Foster? That's a lot of wasted space.
Yeah.
The volume of even the solar system is absolutely incomprehensible. So if you took all the water on Earth or all the water on Mars and the oceans and you blasted into space, you'd have maybe a molecule per cubic mile by the time it got to another planet. I mean, there just isn't that much stuff on a planet when you spread it out across the solar system. Right, Tom?
Yes, that's true.
So that's not going to give us any answers. What's interesting about Mars is...
Richard,
like...
I'm going to have to hold you over a little bit longer, too. Okay. Is that all right? Because we haven't even gotten to the Mars artifacts yet, for crying out loud. Go ahead.
The thing about the MRO data is, even on those initial pictures, there is stunning evidence, which we put up as comparisons, which I showed you a few months ago, back when they first went into orbit, when
yes.
they took those calibrated images. If they continue to have this degree of honesty, putting the data out there, even if they don't say anything, and I'm going to bet you dollars to Navy beans that what the strategy will be is they're going to put out some incredibly provocative pictures. And, Tom, I bet they will not say a word. They'll let us do their saying for them. And they'll hold their finger up and they'll see which way the wind is blowing in terms of the politics of the audience, the constituency, the scientific community, the nature of the evidence that we marshal in favor of the ET hypothesis based on the new data, and then you will see an acceleration of the Bush vision so that Mars is sooner rather than later, and the JPL crowd, which I do agree there are elements there that are fearful for their long-term jobs, they get more robots, so they keep their jobs. And no one has to say, oh, there's life on Mars. They just have to kind of go with the flow. That's my best-case scenario for what could happen next spring if we all do our jobs and this audience inputs to NASA through the mechanisms that are being set up, will be opened up by November for public input. They are actually requesting public requests for data, for photographs, for targeting of things on Mars. And you and I, and maybe Tom, will craft a strategy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if they're going to do it, they're looking for the public to help them.
And it's called plausible deniability, George, the old politic game. Do it, but don't tell anybody you're doing it. And if you don't tell them you're doing it, no one's going to hang you for doing it.
So what if we get them on the program, Tom and Richard, and we're just talking to them about things, and you two are on, and you tell them point blank, why don't you take a picture of this for us?
Well, that's exactly what I would do, because we've done it before. We did it with Art. Remember how we got the first Mars Surveyor pictures in 98? And we've done it, you and I, George, have done it on the missing Apollo tapes in the last 3 weeks. Without us doing those shows, without us doing the updates, without all the people who emailed, who then got censored by some idiots in NASA who didn't want Griffin to see the emails, and it backfired because suddenly there is an official investigation, there's accountability, there's a chain of command, people are now looking for missing Apollo stuff. 15,000 boxes have turned out to be missing, not just 700, like I reported 3 weeks ago. And it's all because of this audience bringing it to the attention of NASA, to the attention of the press, and being a vox populi in a country where actually the people's voice still matters if people get together and make their voices
15,000 boxes? What were they doing, shooting a full-length movie up there?
This is nuts. This is absolutely – this is telemetry. This is all the – this is everything.
Yeah, man, this doesn't make sense. Well, we're going to come back in just a moment with and we'll get into the Mars anomalies. Tom, we've got that picture of those trees that Richard, you and I talked about some time ago, but I want you to react to it as well, Tom. Some people would say that it's merely dust being kicked up from the interior of the planet, but it sure looks like textured trees to me. Actually, they look like those little trees that you'd see if you were building a model railroad set up. They really do. Go to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the picture under feature article, and we'll be right back. Absolutely. We're going to take your phone calls this hour as well with our guest, Tom Van Flandern. We've invited Richard C. Hoagland to join us. He can stay as long as he wants. Richard's kind of like the kind of guy, your friend, that when you invite him in and then you walk him out the front door, you think he's left. He comes in the back door when you're not looking. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Richard, I hope you like that analogy, huh?
I don't know. You know, my grandmother used to have a saying, but I can't say it on the air about, you know, damning with faint praise.
Yeah, exactly. And Tom, too. Tom, this picture we're looking at, and Richard, you jump in as well, and then we've got the phones ringing off the hook here. These pictures of these so-called trees, explain, Thomas, what this is.
Well, it's a region of Mars that might be special in terms of, like, hot springs or special on Earth. where there are objects that look very much like trees. They're maybe a couple hundred meters across, which makes sense in it for a lower gravity field. They have a branch-like structure. The photographs look very much like trees from above. And we've taken them at different seasons, and they do change with the seasons, and they cast shadows on the ground. And the original explanation of some kind of a crystalline structure just didn't hold up at all. If these were taken on Earth, we wouldn't have any doubt that they were trees. They look very much that way. But since it's on Mars, there's a lot of doubt, and we won't know for sure till we get a spacecraft landed in that area to go over and check it out.
What's even more startling to me is not the heavy shrubbery of the trees. It's the small trees on the right-hand side of this picture. Those are remarkable because they're sticking right out of the ground.
Yes, that's right. The whole scene is remarkable. It's one of Arthur C. Clarke's favorite pictures. After he saw that particular image, there are many like it, but that particular one, he said he's now 95% convinced that there's large-scale biology on Mars.
So, Richard, why can't we get MRO, maybe we can, to take pictures of this?
We can. MRO is in a polar orbit. They have asked for the public to give them a list of targets. You and I are going to coordinate that campaign. We're going to make sure the NASA administrator, Mike Griffin, one way or the other, knows about this. All the people in the MRO project, we will get close-up pictures showing detail on the order of inches from this spacecraft, from this 180-mile-high orbit. And all we have to do is to do what our jobs are, which is to keep this in front of the American people and this very special audience. Let me say one other thing. If Tom and I are right, if Mars underwent this incredible catastrophe and it had oceans and it suffered the enormous blows of a planet exploding in its front yard, et cetera, and you had tsunamis and you had atmosphere loss and you had, you know, a planetary cataclysm of a scale that is unimaginable except in the Bible, you'd expect that the surviving life, if this planet had life before, would have migrated or stuck around, persisted in the most habitable places left on the planet, which is the polar regions. That's where the water would have gone. It's called cold trapping. When the atmospheric flows cause it to go to the poles and then freezes out, we now know from the European mission, the Mars Express mission, that under the thin layer of CO2, frozen carbon dioxide, at the South Pole, as well as the North Pole, there are enormous reservoirs of water. If you had a persistent life, and particularly if you had a life form that was different in a Martian way before the catastrophe, more inclined to live in extreme environments, like we have extremophiles in terms of microbes here, then you would logically find life in the one place where there's copious water still, even though it's in a frozen form, because deep down, Tom was right, there could be springs, there could be hot pockets, there could be, you know, liquid, and then it would extend, you know, roots down. It would get sunlight for a year because the poles of Mars are tilted by the same angle roughly as the Earth, so with a Martian orbit twice as long as Earth, the Martian summers in the southern hemisphere are a year long, an Earth year long, and then you'd have a year of darkness, but the plant might be acclimated with some kind of tough membrane and, you know, able to keep vapors inside and protect itself against the very thin atmosphere. In other words, you're looking at all the possibilities for an indigenous Martian life form, part of an ecosystem that would get NASA an absolute gold card. Scientists just plausibly, just conservatively laid out the numbers and the statistics I just did and said we need to know more. Instead, you have the geologists who run JPL saying adamantly, oh, it's just geysers of CO2 and sprays of black dust and slick carbon dioxide, you know, that's transparent. In other words, they are completely eschewing the biological possibilities that are within absolute mainstream scientific discipline right now, and it is the most stupid political thing, unless we are not supposed to think about life on Mars, at any level of NASA or JPL or any other agency at all costs, because if we open the door, George, to life, then we open the door to all the other things that Brookings said could do us in.
Well, I know, but, you know, Richard, if I were NASA official, I'd be jumping all over this picture. I'd be saying, we're going to take pictures of this. We're going to land out here. We're going to send rovers there. I mean,
well, remember, they had
incredible.
A mission called Mars Polar Lander, which was aimed for exactly this terrain. And what happened to it, George?
Well, wasn't that the one where they had the mistake, or is that the one that crashed?
That's the one they claim because of a mistake it crashed.
Yeah.
It's another disappeared mission.
They were using meters or something instead.
No. That was the Mars orbiter, which was going to orbit. This was going to land in the South Pole, right around these trees, these bushes, and it disappeared. And the question is,
you don't think it disappeared, do you?
Well, of course not. See, I know Tom has to remain politically correct because he's got a lot of friends in the agency. I don't. The ones that I...
Well, you never will with this attitude.
Well, the ones that I do know who I am, and they stick by me because they know that I tell the truth as I see it. And I think we have been suckered from day one because there's an agenda. It's driven by Brookings in part. It's driven by the idea that this stuff we can't know because, you know, it would be cats and dogs living together and all that other nonsense. In other words, this is part of a much bigger picture to keep us down on the farm, because if we realize we're not alone in the universe, that we had a much more interesting history, that there's other folks out there, then politically and religiously and every other ism, we will do different things that people in the position of power do not want us to do or think or stray from the straight and narrow of life as it is practiced here and now. Uh-huh. And that, I think, is what's been driving the train. And the only thing that's going to change it, George, is you and me and a few million of our friends listening to us right now tonight.
Well, I gotta tell you, Cydonia is exciting because of the possibilities it was made by beans. This is exciting because, I mean, this is obviously vegetation. I mean,
well, it's obviously something that's not geology, and that's what makes their geological explanation so silly. Tom, would you agree?
Yes, I do agree. They've come up with geological mock explanations for several things, such as the glassy tubes. And in each case, they're easily defeated. A school child could defeat some of the theories.
Well, let's go to some of the phones. When you're on the air, if you have a question for either Richard or Tom or both, just let us know that from the outset, if you would. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how y'all doing tonight?
Good, sir. Where are you calling from, and who's your question for?
I'm calling from Jupiter, Florida, and my question is for Mr. Richard.
Jupiter would be appropriate with this night.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I was with Richard down at Coral Castle.
Ah.
And what happened was my sons have been on fire ever since.
Oh, really?
One just left NASA and for an experiment, and another one's getting ready to go again. And their question to me, because I teach in the schools, and me and Richard sit and talk like the whole time they was there at Coral Castle, and my boys was, of course, roving around like they were Edward. I mean, they just made themselves at home. But Richard, what an inspiration, Mr. George Norrie. I'm so nervous right now because I'm out here working.
Oh, don't be. You're among friends.
Yeah, I know, Richard, but you know, the reason that I'm nervous is because I guess it's the my higher power shaking the truth out of me, because the kids are in question to when this next event happened with Mars. I mean, say with Mars and the Moon aligning next week. They want to know, can they take a needle and stand it straight up on a magnet?
No.
That's the question that the children are acting in the schools, you know, and even my kids are real curious.
Tom, you want to handle that one?
I'm still thinking about the supposed alignment.
Is there some force that would, during the alignment of the Moon and Mars, allow you to do anything with needles and magnets that you couldn't do any other time?
Well, certainly not gravitationally. The gravitational forces of any alignment are too minuscule to detect even with our most sensitive instruments.
Okay. Hey, Lurie, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
This is Renee calling from Seal Beach.
Okay.
And speaking of children, this is applies to both gentlemen. I hope I'm not so far out. It sounds like everybody else has some curious things to say. I am a musician, and I have a very curious group of young children. I've done a lot of research in the last 15 years regarding vibration. And you were talking about anything penetrating gravity, penetrating or breaking down matter in such a way that some of these anomalies could be built, even maybe the ones here on Earth. I'm wondering if you have any, maybe even suggestions upon reading as well as something to offer regarding this. Has anyone brought this kind of thing up?
I guess not.
Okay. Well, these children, just by the way, to give you a clue, they compose, but they also build upon music. They think that it's matter broken down, and what they see in their mind is an incredible, beautiful movie. And paintings show this as well. But I'm talking about 3-4-year-olds, and sometimes you get some very honest answers. So I thought possibly that if matter was broken down, it could be done by sound somehow, or used to build.
Well, wasn't Tesla close to developing, Richard, something like that?
Well, sound is a metaphor for frequencies, for vibrations. And there's a whole category of physics, you know, that seems to have been kind of eclipsed by relativity, but it actually is bringing back the idea that there is an ether, there's an energetic medium. The vacuum is not a vacuum. It's not an absence of stuff. It's actually filled with energy, which is in the form of vibrations and waves, invisible transmission of information and energy. And so these kids are in tune, pun intended, with some of the cutting-edge physics that is bringing back the ether. And, in fact, one of the things I'm going to be discussing at the CPAC conference at the University of California the week following our Joshua Tree thing is some of the actual experiments that seem to demonstrate that we are moving, the Earth is moving through the ether with a measurable velocity that has been now detected by several experiments that just happened to get enough notoriety in the mainstream scientific community to be noticed and basically discussed.
Tom, when we talk about Cydonia, the original pictures that Viking took that Richard showed us that were in the monuments on Mars, and then we had the high-res pictures. It was very disappointing. You know, people said, well, that's the MESA now just looks like something natural. What was your take on all of that?
Well, the picture that was released by JPL was multiply filtered, you may recall.
This was the first one in 98.
Yes.
In April of 98.
The one that I saw first on USA Today, right?
The one that Art called the cat box image.
Yes.
That's right. They have a website that shows the actual spacecraft image and the one they released to the press and the recipe of how they got from one to the other. And they put the real image through a high-pass filter, which removes low-frequency detail. Then they put it through a low-pass filter that removes high-frequency detail. Then they averaged the two, and the result was a washed-out image that no one could possibly think was anything but natural. And I don't think that it was quite so conspiratorial as the end product, because I think what really happened is they tried all the filters they had and laid out a bunch of images on the table from the image processing lab and had the public information office come along, and they said, that one over there, that one looks like it will get out the message we want to get out, which is that this is a waste of public funds. Let's run that one.
All right, what if we had just seen a unfiltered picture? What would it have looked like? What do you think?
It would have really brought the story much more into the mainstream, because the unfiltered picture shows that the original Viking image just showed the impression of an eye socket, a nose, and a mouth.
Right.
The high-resolution image showed that the eye socket had an eyebrow over it.
Oh, my.
An iris in the eye socket, that the nose was tapered, there were two nostrils at the end, the mouth had parted lips, it was a complete face.
Oh, my God.
See, this is where the political spin of the spin doctors in this agency has been so deleterious, because everybody was hanging on the Mars Surveyor images.
Yes.
You know, Stan McDaniel and I worked, and other people worked, David Webb and Tom and Mark Carlotto, to get NASA to take the images. And when NASA refused, Malin refused, Art, you know, was able to exert pressure through this audience, and they mandated that NASA had to take the pictures. So they did everything they could to make it look as lousy as possible, and their target was not the American people. Their target were Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw.
Yeah.
When those three esteemed geologists, looking at this crappy image, intoned solemnly that night, "Oh, it's just a hill," I don't care if we had taken pictures a year later of naked dancing girls on the nose of the face on Mars. The media was no longer paying attention, and the smart guys in NASA knew this, that if they killed it in the bud after years and years of anticipation, nobody would come back. There's nothing deader than a 90-day wonder, as they used to say.
Well, did you have damage? Did you have damage control then after this had happened? Did you have to struggle to convince people that this was still alive? Yeah, that's what I thought.
Absolutely. And you know it yourself from looking at your emails.
Oh, yeah.
So
George,
this is where MRO, see, now we're into what I call the Gigi factor. Remember that great movie, Tom, with Marie Chevalier? And there was this song in it, "Have I Been Standing Up Too Close or Back Too Far?" With the imagery we now have, we've been standing kind of in the mid-range. We are too close to see the overall artistic shape of this anymore for most people, and we're too far away to see the structural details. I've been saying on this program and other venues, and I'm going to tell this network that's coming to film me in a few weeks, with MRO, we will finally get to see the girders. We'll get to see how this thing was built. It's not a carved Mount Rushmore. It's a amalgam of high-tech and low-tech stuff. The fractal results Carlotto got showed us that years ago. And again, we have a brief opportunity to snag the attention of the media. And they're the ones we got to focus on. And if they see building blocks and bricks and girders and, you know, beams and struts, then we'll have won.
So
that's what we have to do.
You're saying, though, Tom, that there is an unfiltered high-res image of Cydonia that shows all those details?
Yes, that's right. It's out there, and it's even on the JPL website. They had to show the actual image and not just the filtered one, or they'd be accused of fraud over this.
Well,
that was the one Carlotta was able to take and make look like it really would have looked like if the JPL
process
had been honest. But by that time, nobody in the media was paying attention.
All right, we'll be back. We'll take final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tom, let's use your theory of the exploded planet then. At what point are there inhabitants on Mars allowing them to do what they were doing there, building small cities, maybe pyramids, the face on Mars?
Well, a couple parts of the theory we didn't touch on tonight, but the answer to your question is that probably in the period between 65 million years ago when the big planet exploded and about 3.2 million years ago when a second of the twin moons exploded. That's when the builders would have been active, and the civilization probably ended about 3.2 million years ago, which is an interesting date because that's around the time of the oldest humanoid fossils on this planet.
Do you think then that they were on that planet? They were on Mars after the fact or during?
Good question, but if they were going to survive, they would have had to migrate to Earth, at some early point, or this, they would have had to seek shelter from the explosion. They could have gotten onto the far side of Mars and been sheltered there, but the safer thing to do, I think, would be to get to Earth if they had that capability.
Okay, let's go to the calls now with our two guests. Wildcard Line, welcome to the show. You're on the air. Who's your question for?
This is Sean from Dillsboro, Arkansas. I've actually got two questions. The first one's for Tom, and the second one's for Richard.
All right, sure thing.
All right, Tom, you said earlier about over in the distant future about the moon getting further out and actually coming to a point where it got locked in.
Yes,
point
that's right.
With the Earth.
Yes.
Okay. Did you say the Earth would stop on its axis at that point, stop spinning? Is that what you're saying?
It would keep the same face toward the moon. Yes, it would still there'd still be a slow spin as the moon orbited. The Earth would slowly turn too, but always keeping the same face toward the moon.
Okay, I was wondering about that because I thought you meant it would completely stop. I was going to ask if that meant one side of the planet would kind of cook where the other side would freeze. You know, if one side was steadily facing the sun.
Right, I understand, but the reality would be that a day would be about 30 present days long.
Okay.
We'd have 30 about a month of continuous sunlight and then a month of continuous darkness.
Okay. My second question for both of y'all guys. Have y'all ever heard of the planet swap theory?
I haven't. How about you guys?
Okay.
I've heard of version. What's your version?
Okay. Well, me and my science teacher back when I was in school, we'd talk about this. What we talk about was, say you take like Earth and Jupiter and you flip-flop their points in the solar system, like put Jupiter where Earth is and put Earth where Jupiter is. I'm just using a guesstimate here. Would the gravitational pull, since they're different size and mass and density, like if you put Jupiter where Earth is, would the gravity of the sun actually pull it into it, or would it keep going on the same route like Earth does now?
Same route.
You know, because of their different size and mass and a different type of gravitational pull.
The size of the planet doesn't affect its own orbit at all. Or remember Galileo's experiment on the Tower of Pisa? He dropped a heavy and a light ball and proved for the first time that they fell and hit the ground at the same time, so that it doesn't matter how big or small the object is. When it falls a gravitational field, they all fall the same.
Okay, so it wouldn't matter if they were swapped. It'd be they'd go on the same path as they do now.
Yes.
Okay, I was just curious about that.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Tom and Richard, do you think our fate here on planet Earth will be much the same then as these exploded planets in the rest of the solar system?
Well, someday, yes, but since that's billions of years in the future, we'll be very fortunate indeed if humanity doesn't get wiped out by something else in the meantime.
I agree, but why did these other planets then blow up so quicker than what we would?
Well, they started out with different masses and different conditions, and the explosions are well spaced in time. For example, the most recent two planet explosions were 250 million years ago and 65 million years ago. So that makes it a little difficult to think in terms of planetary wars or mining, because you got a gap of almost 200 million years between explosions.
You know, Tom, one of the things I've always wanted to ask you is, have you ever made a graph? I mean, all science begins in pattern recognition. Have you ever made a graph and laid out these posited worlds and their estimated mass and angular momentum and orbital distance from the sun and tried to produce some kind of a predictive model as to how the explosions depend on other factors?
Well, the answer is yes, but some of the factors that I think are relevant weren't even on your list yet.
Okay.
For example, one big factor is that if these planets originally fission from the sun, they all start as huge balls of hydrogen. Now, if the original ball of hydrogen is above a certain mass, most of the hydrogen will be retained, and you'll have a gas giant such as Jupiter, which is mostly hydrogen.
Right.
But if it's below a certain mass, the hydrogen, being the lightest element, is the easiest to escape from the planet, so almost all the hydrogen escapes, but that's almost all of the mass.
Right.
And the result is, once all the volatile elements go away, you're left with a very small planet of very heavy elements, something like the Earth. So the selection of which elements stay and which go is probably far more important than any of the other factors that you named.
Okay, now we've got something like 180 extra solar planets, and Marcy, what's his name, Gary, is it Gene or Gary Marcy?
I'm not sure either.
The astronomer in San Francisco who's finding Jeff Marcy.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be at this conference, and I'm going to ask him, what do you see in the way of regularities, of patterns that would be applicable to the solar system vis-a-vis Tom Van Flandern's model? Because we now have more than 9 or 12, you know, examples here. We have almost 200 spread across a reasonable volume of our part of the spiral arm of the Milky Way, and we should be able to start discerning patterns of what planets have a tendency to blow up.
I think Velikovsky would have liked you, Tom.
I mean, it is so cool for me to know Tom and to watch this theory, which started out at that DPS meeting in my mind. I mean, he'd been actively talking about it for some years before. But in my lifetime, I have watched it go from just a twinkle in Tom's eye to point after point after point of confirmation. And I got to hand it to you, Tom. You are a pioneer. I am going to live long enough to see you venerated as the appropriate scientist you are for a theory whose time has come that is overwhelmingly supported by the data and is only held back now by the politics of NASA.
That's very well put, Richard. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Elliot out of Tempe, Arizona.
Sure, Elliot.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm a little nervous.
Who's your question for, Elliot?
For Richard, but I have a quick dream I wanted to tell you. It involves George, Richard, and Art. We were scuba diving, you, me, and there was this woman. She was a scientist. She had this test equipment, and you were in your suit and tie.
Scuba diving in a suit and tie? That's me, huh?
We came up through this hole in the ground, and there was a fire truck and an ambulance, and Richard Hoagland came riding up on a bicycle, and the ambulance driver grabbed him off the bicycle, and the fireman put the oxygen mask on him, and he said, "There's nothing wrong with me." Art Bell was leaning up against the wall laughing.
You have a vivid dream life.
Vivid, vivid. Art would be doing that to us, wouldn't he? Okay, go ahead with your question.
What I want to know, what would be the possibility of underground life on Mars like we have reptilian life here on Earth?
Good question. I'll let you listen on your radio. Richard, that was for you.
Okay. Well, Dr. Formosino, who is the PI on a very interesting spectrometer on the Mars Express mission, believes he has found methane supported by Earth-based observations. People in Washington at the Catholic University and I think Dr. Mumma at Goddard that seem to indicate that there's something belching forth methane into the Martian atmosphere, which, unless it was life, there almost is no other rational explanation for what could be producing that much methane. And recently, the numbers got bigger because apparently methane has other ways of being destroyed on Mars other than the way it's destroyed here on Earth. So it would indicate there could be a very active subterranean bacterial colony, microbial colony. Whether you have larger life, whether the guys that Tom and I think used to live on Mars went underground and are living in versions of McMurdo Sound, you know, the ice station we have at the South Pole under the ice in part, we won't know until we land, until we actually have expeditions. But it's not beyond the realm of scientific possibility once you look at this assembled data and you see evidence of astonishing artifacts that do not belong on Mars.
You know, it's funny, Richard and Tom, when I was about 12 years old and started studying some science and looking at the asteroid belt, I said at that time to myself, just out of the blue, I said, that there had to have been a planet there that blew up. And to this day, I still believe it. And Tom, seeing you form it now is pretty neat for me.
Well, thanks, George. It is a fairly obvious idea, and it was first proposed in 1802 on just that basis, but it wasn't politically correct for the times. And a champion of the exploded planet hypothesis early on, Lagrange, had the misfortune to die shortly after he announced his findings and wasn't able to follow up all the attacks that came on his result.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is Marty from Fox Island, Washington State.
Sure.
And questions for Tom. And it's question is about the sun, well, spinning off, fissioning off, I guess you would say, you know, like two planets at a time. And that's the first I've heard of that. And I was then, a little later on, you were talking about how the moon, theoretically, was fissioned off from the Earth. And I was curious how come it wouldn't fission off to...
Where's the other moon?
Right.
No, it's a very good point. The fission theory says that if the parent body is gaseous or liquid, then overspinning, it will bulge out on both sides pretty much equally, and then when one side breaks off, there'll be a snapback effect, which breaks off the other side. But if it's a solid planet, you don't get that snapback effect. So a solid planet, will, when it overspins, will tend to fission on one side, but has enough internal strength that it doesn't fission on the other side. It just snaps back into place.
It's kind of like a big teardrop coming out.
Yeah, right. So the general rule is solid bodies form singlet moons, and gaseous or liquid bodies form twin pairs.
Great question.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Next up, Wildcard Line, you're up. Good morning. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. First time caller.
Thanks,
General
Chris.
Question for you, Dr. Hoagland.
It's not doctor, but thanks anyway.
We've given you an honorary PhD, Richard.
Mr. Hoagland, then. Let us think conceptually that the artifacts on Mars, the trees, all that good jazz, and let us just say that time travel becomes possible in the future. At 1,000 years, give it 2,000, whatever. Is there the possibility that the remains that we have found on Mars, if they do come to truth, which I think they are remains of a future time travel expedition to Mars, and the possibility that we here on Earth are here because a group of scientists, a culture, a nation, whatever, wants to make sure that the human race comes to fruition that it is now. I call it the Ouroboros effect. I'll listen to your guys' call. Have a nice day.
Okay, thanks. Who wants it?
Well, I commented earlier that time travel is a logical impossibility because it gets into these paradoxes, such as you could go back and kill your own grandfather, which means you would never have been born, so you couldn't have done that. So that's the knock against time travel, but maybe the concept can be put in a more plausible way to say there may be other species out there more intelligent than us, and it's entirely feasible to imagine that they look out for species and make sure they don't go extinct the way we tend to do right here on our own planet. We try to save species that are in danger of extinction.
Okay, great. A couple more calls, and we are done for the night. First-time caller line. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Adam Farmer. It's a pleasure talking to you, George.
Thanks,
and,
Adam.
Well, my question is, it's for Tom or Rich, whichever one, but, you know, if, say, a planet were to explode and the debris or fragments from that planet collide into another planet, could that cause pretty much a domino effect causing that planet to explode and then hit another planet, causing that one to explode and just wiping out an entire solar system?
Like a chain reaction.
Right.
I don't think so. Even though, you know, the catastrophe on the surface would be horrendous, the planet itself would hardly notice unless the chunks were really, really, really huge. And you basically don't have big chunks because this would tend to fragment the liquid mantles, and the core material would kind of stay pretty much where it is, and the mantle material goes to dust and vapor and becomes droplets and basically very fine stuff. So probably not. What do you think, Tom?
Right.
Tom?
Oh, yes. I think I'd agree with Richard's remarks, and just add that space is so huge that you have to wander around for millions of years before you're likely to run into a planet. It just couldn't happen without some direction. I mean, you know, by aiming, which couldn't happen with a natural event.
We are out of time. Gentlemen, Tom, I want to thank you for being part of the program tonight, and let's hope in the not-too-distant future we get a little more data to help you prove your theory. Appreciate it, Tom.
Thank you so much, George.
And Richard, just in the last 30 seconds or so, tell me what's up with Joshua Tree.
Well, at Joshua Tree, I'm going to be showing a stunning picture that I'm going to send to Tom because of his graciousness tonight. We have found an ocean liner on Mars.
What?
Absolutely, unequivocally, an ocean liner, Tom. When you see the data, you will absolutely jump for joy. MRO is going to target it over my you-know-what, and we will know conclusively next year, but we're going to show the image for the first time at Joshua Tree, and George, if you come, you'll get to see it.
Are you sure it's not Noah's Ark?
Nope. It looks like the Queen Elizabeth or the Ile-de-France,
oh, that's
or
dramatic.
One of those big, incredible...
Hoagland, I've got to see this one.
You will.
Okay, my friend. Take care, both of you.
You too. Good night, Tom.
Good night, Richard and George.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it. And again, look at the Coast to Coast website. Look at that picture amazes me of those trees on Mars. Absolutely stunning. And Tom's website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. RichardsEnterpriseMission.com. Phone number for Joshua Tree if you don't have a computer, 800-900-7030. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.